You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 36 of a series in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew chapter 25. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish and five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here is the bridegroom! Come out to meet him!" Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "There will not be enough for us and for you. Go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterwards, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." We'll pause our reading there after verse 13 of Matthew 25. Now, this little parable follows directly after Matthew 24. And if you've listened to the last episode or read Matthew 24, you'll know that there Jesus talks both about the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 by the Romans, but also about his return as the Son of Man in power and glory at the very end of the age. And he tells us that nobody knows the day or the hour of that date, including himself at that time as an incarnate man. And so at the end of Matthew 24, Jesus says the day will come like a thief in the night. He uses that image. And that carries over now into Matthew 25 and this parable of a wedding feast. And the virgins who are invited to welcome the bridegroom, presumably part of the wedding traditions in Judaism at that time. But five of them are foolish and don't take enough oil, as if you needed a torch at night and didn't take spare batteries with you. And so they run out of oil because the coming of the bridegroom is delayed. Now, that's also interesting because there is this idea that goes around that Jesus, or at least the disciples, thought that Jesus was going to come again within their lifetime. That's based on that saying in Matthew 24, where Jesus says this generation will not pass away before all of these things take place. But as I said in the last episode, that statement does not necessarily mean that the disciples will be alive at the time of Jesus' return, because those days that he's referring to, or these things rather that he refers to, might simply mean AD 70 and not the very end. And the term generation doesn't necessarily refer only to those who are alive at that time. It could refer to a period of God's operation, an age in which Jesus is saying that nothing new, nothing different will happen until the return of Jesus in glory. So, but this parable gives us the idea that there could be a delay, that his coming may take a lot longer than is expected. So I think it's wrong to suggest that the disciples believed Jesus must come again during their lifetime. I think they undoubtedly would have hoped that he would, as Christians in every age should hope, and we ought to hope that as well today, but they certainly didn't believe that it must happen. Anyway, these foolish bridesmaids or virgins didn't have enough oil. The wise ones didn't have enough to spare to give to them as well, so they had to go to the dealers. But the end result is that they get shut out of the feast. And the bridegroom says, "Truly, I say to you, I do not know you." Now, of course, it's dangerous to take every detail of a parable literally as describing a reality. They are stories to make a point. And the point of this parable is quite clear, that we need to be ready. We need to be alert. We need to be prepared for the coming of Jesus. But it is terribly sad to think of some to whom Jesus says, "I do not know you." Isn't that what he says later on in this chapter, in the story of the sheep and the goats? "Depart from me. I never knew you." Or sorry, I'm mixing up my passages. He doesn't say that in the parable later, which we will come to later in this episode, but he says it back in at the end of the Sermon on the Mount at the in Matthew chapter 7 to those people who had cast out demons in his name. And he says, I never knew you, depart from me. That's Matthew 7 verse 23. So there is this sense of a final judgment, of a separation of the wise from the foolish, of those who are prepared from those who are not, of those who, as Jesus put it in Matthew 24, endure to the end and so are saved, and those who do not endure to the end. The idea of a wedding feast is also significant because earlier on in Matthew, you might remember, Jesus referred to himself in terms of a bridegroom, Matthew chapter 9, verse 15, when he's asked why don't his disciples fast the way John the Baptist's disciples do. He says, can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away and they will fast. So he clearly positions himself as a bridegroom. And of course, Revelation tells us about the coming wedding feast of the Lamb, the marriage supper of the Lamb, Revelation 19, verses 6 to 9. You can read about that. That is the fulfillment of an image from the Old Testament where God describes himself as a husband to his people, to Israel, who took Israel and brought Israel to himself and clothed her in fine clothes. And yet Israel was adulterous and unfaithful to him. But that image of God being united in covenant with his people carries over into Jesus' image of the bridegroom. And of course, that must have been in the minds of his disciples when they heard this parable of a wedding feast. So the reality is that some will be left out of the wedding feast because they are not ready. Jesus will say, truly, I say, I don't know you. So we need to watch, verse 13. We don't know the day or the hour. Let's read on then in Matthew 25, verse 14. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, to each according to his ability. Then he went away. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded with them, and he made 5 talents more. So also he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. But he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of the servants came and settled accounts with them. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And he also who had the 2 talents came forward, saying, Master, you delivered to me 2 talents. Here I have made 2 talents more. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. He also who had received the 1 talent came forward, saying, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours. But his master answered him, You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I could have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. For to everyone who has more will more be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. We'll pause there again at verse 30. Again, a parable about judgment and separation between two kinds of people. We've had the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. And here this phrase, which came at the end of chapter 24 as well, this weeping and gnashing of teeth, This idea of being left out right at the very end of Matthew 24, it talks about the master of the servant who will come. It's a very similar image in at the end of chapter 24. It's a wicked servant who thinks because the master's delayed, he can treat his fellow servants whatever way he likes, beat them and behave whatever way he likes. But the master comes, cuts him to pieces, puts him with the hypocrites. And there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, the idea of regret being left out. This parable of the talents, again, we need to be careful in relating that directly to spiritual realities. What the servant, the slothful servant, says about the master cannot be true about God or about the Lord Jesus. You're a hard man, reaping where you didn't sow, gathering where you scattered no seed. God, of course, cannot sow, reap where he didn't sow, because everything belongs to him. He cannot gather where he scattered no seed, because he sows seed everywhere. So either that reflects a misunderstanding of the character of God, or it's not relevant to who God is. That's not describing the nature of God. But it's how the servant thinks about his master. Now we have three servants. They're given different amounts of money. It's interesting. A talent, by the way, it doesn't mean a talent in the way we use that word today, but a monetary unit. It was worth about 20 years of a laborer's wages. So a single talent is a huge amount, 20 years of wages. Five talents is a massive amount. Two is a very big amount. Even one is huge. So sometimes we look at this comparatively and we say that's a bit unfair, but it's not at all unfair. All three of them are given massive amounts of money to be entrusted with, and all three according to their ability. Now, of course, if we're to relate this to our experience, we need to recognize God's sovereignty in giving us the abilities that we have and the opportunities that we have. We could think about the gifts that God has given us, whether those are wealth and possessions, or whether those are abilities to do things. We could think about the opportunities that he gives us in life. Some of us are given more than others. That's not unfair. That is God's sovereign purpose in distributing to us. And God does not expect us to look after more than we are able to look after. So there's no point in complaining or comparing or being jealous of what others have been given. Our responsibility is simply to look at what we have been given and to make good use of it. Two of the servants do that. They trade with the master's money and they double it. The one buries it. And the reason that he gives is because he's afraid of the master. I don't think that's the real reason, though, because what the master says to him is, "You wicked and slothful servant." In other words, I think the real issue here is not so much his fear of the master, whether he has misunderstood the master's character, or whether he has made an accurate assessment of it and is fearful. That's his excuse, fear. But the master doesn't let him away with it. The master says, "You are slothful, you're lazy." And I think that's the real root issue here, that this man is lazy and he cannot be bothered working hard. It's easier just to bury the talent and get on with the life that he wants to live. So at the end of chapter 24, we have a servant who is wicked because he mistreats the other servant. Here we have a servant who is wicked because he's lazy and doesn't bother to use what's entrusted to him in his master's servant service. And that leads to judgment. He has taken from him the talent that he had, and he's cast into the outer darkness, verse 30. Clearly a picture of losing out on salvation, missing out on the kingdom of God. The other two servants get a reward. But notice what their reward is. It's the "well done, good and faithful servant," and they enter into the joy of your master. and the opportunity to serve more. You've been faithful over a little, I will set you over much. Even at the end, when it says the one talent was taken from the wicked, slothful servant and given to the one who has 10, it doesn't mean that the reward, you know, we get more for ourselves as our reward. Sometimes people think about rewards in heaven and they sort of think in those terms. It's like, oh, I'll have more than you do. I'll build up treasure for myself in heaven. But that's the wrong understanding. The joy of heaven is to share in the joy of the Master and to serve him, to be faithful over more. What God is doing now is training us for eternal service. And by learning now to use the gifts and opportunities and abilities that God has given us, we are being prepared to serve him eternally. It's not that we will take that and have it for ourselves like a big retirement pot that we can just enjoy for ourselves throughout eternity, but it is that we will be able to enjoy serving God more and being with him, celebrating in his joy and hearing his commendation as good and faithful servants. That ought to be enough. That ought to inspire us. So again, clearly this parable is challenging us to say, which will we be? Will we be like the servant who is lazy and makes excuses for himself and blames the master, in fact, for his laziness? Or will we be like a faithful servant who gets the point that whatever we have is entrusted to us by God for his service and his glory, and will have eternal consequences, that what we do now for God will result in glory for him, and will result in treasure in heaven, and will result in us learning how we can serve God eternally. Let's read then the last part of Matthew chapter 25, beginning at verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right, but the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me, naked, and you did not clothe me, sick and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they also will answer, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you?" Then he will answer them, saying, "Truly I say to you, as you did not do it to the one of the least of these, you did not do it to me." And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Ending our reading there at the end of Matthew chapter 25, that's verse 46. Now, this, again, is an image of judgment and clearly follows on that theme from the parables that have preceded. Is it a parable? Well, it's not structured entirely like a parable. In fact, there's no reason to think it's a parable at all. It talks about the people being like sheep and goats, the way a shepherd separates, not that it's talking about a shepherd separating sheep and goats. So it's not a story from the things of this world. It's a description of things that will happen. And so I think we can take that literally. This will actually happen. The Son of Man coming in glory, that's what Jesus talked about in Matthew 24, he's referring to his own return in glory and the angels with him, and he will sit on a throne and he will gather the nations. Now, please notice that. I think this account of the judgment is sometimes misunderstood and misused. I've heard it often used to encourage Christians to be engaged in social action, in looking after the marginalised, the poor, and those who are in prison. And of course, that's something that Christians should be exercised to do. It's absolutely right that people would encourage us to do that. But whenever those people use this passage, they tend to say that when you serve those people, you're serving Jesus, because that's how Jesus describes it. That people say, well, when did we serve you? And he says, well, as much as you served others, you served me. But except he doesn't say that. Notice he doesn't say as much as you serve others. He says in verse 40, the king says, truly I say, as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers. Again in verse 45, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. Now that's important. The people that they do it to are not just anyone, but specifically the least of Jesus' brothers. And this is language, of course, that we've seen already in Matthew chapter 18. The little ones is the phrase that Jesus uses there. And there it's clearly referring to those who are believers in Jesus. Again, in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus talks about those who are his disciples, chapter 12, verse 49, being his mother and his brothers. So the people that Jesus says these people have been good towards, have been kind towards, have cared for, are not just any people. They are very specifically Jesus' people, his family, his believers, his disciples. So the judgment here is not on the basis of deeds as such, but it is on the basis of how people have treated Jesus' people. You see this again in the book of Acts when the Apostle Paul was met by Jesus on the road to Damascus. Jesus doesn't say to Paul, why are you persecuting my people? He says, why are you persecuting me? The way we treat Jesus' people is how we're treating him. And this is the continuation of a principle that runs right throughout the Old Testament from the time of Abraham, back in Genesis chapter 12. When God called Abraham, this is what he said to him, in Genesis 12, verse 3. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonours you I will curse. Now that principle, which is part of God's covenant with Abraham, that the nations that surround Abraham and his family will be judged by God on the basis of how they treat God's people. That runs right through the story of Israel. The nations will be judged, the nations that judge Israel, that punish Israel, will be judged by God. The nations that bless Israel will receive a blessing from God. And it carries right through to the Lord Jesus as well. Because Jesus, of course, is the fulfillment of those promises to Abraham. He is the seed of Abraham, of Genesis 22, and that's made clear in the New Testament, through whom God's blessing will come to all the families and all the peoples of the earth. Because God continues in Genesis 12 to say that in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So blessing comes through blessing God's chosen people. Specifically, blessing comes ultimately through blessing Jesus. Those who trust in Jesus will be blessed. Those who reject Jesus will be cursed. But what Jesus is saying in Matthew 25 is something even more than that, that when the nations are judged, they will be judged on the basis of how they have treated God's people. So the application of this is not so much to encourage individual Christians to go and do good deeds, although that's a good thing. The challenge here is to say to the nations that those nations that persecute God's people, that persecute Christians, will face severe judgment from Jesus. And those nations that bless God's people, that treat them well, will be rewarded by him. Now, that opens a question for us, doesn't it? And the question is, does that mean that there will be people who are saved eternally, not because they were Christians, but because of how they treated Christians? And to that, I can't give an answer. I think if we read this passage literally as describing the final judgment, then that possibility is open, yes. But I think it would be unwise to build any firm doctrine on that. But I think we see hints of that as well in the book of Romans chapter 2, that some will be saved who never heard the gospel because they responded to the light that they did have. So it's possible that that includes some people here. But let us be encouraged, because this is a passage that should bring encouragement to persecuted Christians and to all Christians, to know that Jesus so identifies himself with his people. We are his body. We are indwelt by his spirit. We are the presence of Jesus in the world. That Jesus will defend his people. He will vindicate them. He will protect them. And he will hold to account those who persecute them. And there will be blessing for those who bless his people. And although I don't think the passage is primarily a challenge to Christians about how we live, it should also challenge us, shouldn't it, in terms of how we treat our fellow believers. It's right that we ought to do good to everyone as we are able. But as the Apostle Paul says in Galatians chapter 6, verse 10, that is especially true for the household of faith. Paul says, while we have time, let's do good to all people, but especially to those who are of the household of faith. We have a primary and first responsibility to our fellow Christians. Our church communities should be places of genuine and sincere care for one another, similar to the church in Jerusalem, as it's described for us in Acts chapter 2 and Acts 4, as they cared for one another as needs arose. How can I bless God and curse the one for whom Jesus died? You get these challenges in the New Testament, don't you? I can't claim to love Jesus and to hate my brother. So love for our brothers and sisters is absolutely commanded by Jesus, and this account of the final judgment should challenge us to recognise just how seriously Jesus takes how we treat his people, his brothers and his sisters. So let us love our brothers and sisters, but let's have confidence that we can know Jesus, that we can be wise, unlike the foolish bridesmaids, the foolish virgins. We can be like those good and faithful servants who use what God has entrusted to us for his glory and service. And we are the people, the least of these, his brothers, who others will be judged against how they treat us.